Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
And welcome to the ATS Mix. It's episode 92. I am Johnny Anonymous.
And I'm Dave Rabbit, still stuck in dial-up hell in Corpus Christi, Texas. What's happening, John?
Not a lot. I know that you've got something you want to share with everybody, so let's tell everybody real quick who we have on the show. This week we've got, of course, our UFO sightings.
Yeah, then after that we've got another hilarious episode of the Skeptic Overview with our favorite CEO of the AboveTopSecret.com network, Bill Irvin.
And then we wrap up our interview with Dr. Michio Kaku. This is part two of a great interview with him, and you guys are not going to believe what you're going to hear on this interview.
I'm on the beach. I'm walking. My son flew down, and we're walking on the beach. And I have never seen this in all my years of coming to Corpus Christi and Padre Island. I've never seen a Muslim on the beach.
Muslim
now,
on the beach.
I just assume it's a Muslim. It was a Muslim woman.
All right.
Now, her husband had a bathing suit on,
all right.
And the little kids had little, you know, kid bathing suits on. But this lady standing there, I mean, 5 feet from the waves that are crashing in, and she's got the burba on, okay? The only thing that's exposed is her eyes, okay? And so I see this, and, you know, I start laughing, and I turn to my son, and I say, well, which one of us wants to ask her if we could rub some suntan lotion on her eyelids? I don't know.
Oh,
you know,
my goodness.
What the hell are you doing to the beach if you've got a burba on? That made no sense to me. I'm sorry, John.
It's time to start the show.
Oh, perfect timing. Send those U2Us to Johnny.
This is ATS Mix.
What? Whoa, what am I hearing?
What is this?
From AboveTopSecret.com.
Oh, crap!
Here are your anomalous sightings
from around the world.
This is Tamriel from Godbox Cafe with sightings from across Canada. Three friends gathered at Dudley Park in British Columbia at noon on July 20th and looked up to find two white objects moving around each other, soon to be joined by a third, which emerged over the neighboring trees. They maintained a close watch on the three white lights long enough to catch sight of two more appearing over the trees. Another, moving slower than the five they were tracking, was a bright red. Over the course of 3 hours, the observers kept monitoring the objects, and the witness reporting commented that this seemed like a scouting mission and that the objects could not have been man-made. The first three lights quickly disappeared, and at that point, the friends left the site. That same night, at around 11:15 p.m. in Winnipeg, Manitoba, a witness was driving home along Highway 6 and saw two lights, one of which was low to the ground, possibly 20 feet, above a nearby grain elevator at the perimeter. The light closest to the grain elevator became brighter as it descended at a slow, steady pace. The second light was not as bright and remained static. A thin layer of fog obstructed the driver's view, and the witness decided to pull over. In so doing, the observer noted that the light was brighter and lower than the grain elevator. In relation to the size of the grain elevator, the light was bigger than a van. The view through the windshield was now clear, and in looking to the rear of the vehicle, the driver noticed that a car, van, and a semi-truck had also pulled over to have a look at the same phenomenon, and two of the others were talking about the event. The witness reporting proceeded to phone their mother and tell her what was happening. After 5 minutes, the last disappeared, and all witnesses drove off. 2 days later, on the evening of July 22nd, a witness in Scarborough, Ontario, saw four big round lights above the apartment building, which would circle, come in together, then split two by two, and circle again for approximately 1 hour, at which point they moved further north, out of view. This is Tamriel from Godbox Cafe, keeping my eyes to the skies for AboveTopSecret.com.
These are the reported sightings over the United States. This is David C. In North Carolina, two observers stopped in the street and looked up in the direction of lightning and saw a single glowing, silent, bluish-green round orb. The viewer stated, "We watched it ascend and fade into the distance in about 60 seconds. It had a smooth spline flight path, but not exactly straight. It moved like it could be a self-illuminated turquoise balloon, but its size was much bigger than the regular basketball-sized party balloon. If you hold out your arm and look at your pinky fingernail, it was about that size in the sky, and we would guess a few thousand feet away at least. So I would estimate it to be at least the size of a van. Maybe a third the size of a hot air balloon, but a party balloon that size in the sky would only be a few houses away, maybe 200 feet. The thing was up in the sky and getting higher and drifting away at a pretty good speed. It had to be bigger. It glowed a strange color. Not green color like a streetlight, more of a turquoise color. I say it was more green, and my wife says it was more blue, but we both agree it was turquoise. It was completely silent, and straight above us was clear sky with no clouds and bright white stars. It was not bright like Venus was that night. It was dimmer, but still clearly defined against the sky. Possibly it was brighter at the center than the edges of the object, but I can't say for certain." In Wyoming, a viewer was camping when a bright light caught her attention from the right side. She said, "I turned to look and saw a pea or dime-sized glowing sparkly sphere of light above the trees toward the hills to the south. For 3 seconds it moved to the right and downwards, went behind some tree branches, then appeared again for another 3 seconds or so, continuing downwards, and then disappeared behind more tree branches. Its flight was jagged or corkscrewing slightly, not completely smooth, and it was not going fast, but just drifting along somewhat erratically. Its outline was not distinct, but the glow was circular in form, and the sparkly appearance might be better described as an internal fire exuding streaks or sparks of light." This is David C. reporting for AboveTopSecret.com.
And now it's time for a different view. This is the Skeptic Overview.
And, of course, it is time once again for us to get around the coffee table. I hope you have yourself a nice mug of hot steaming coffee or tea sitting beside you, because it's coffee chat with the Skeptic Overlord. And this is the Skeptic Overview.
Well, I have bourbon. I don't have any coffee.
Hey, well, listen. All right, yes. So you got a lot of neat stuff. And we got your email, and we saw this. I mean, it's a marvelous topic. So why don't you start us off, Bill?
The number one topic over the past week is, surprise, surprise, another alien topic. Those aliens and UFOs really seem to be coming with incredible frequency, as the mainstream media is also picking up on it. And it's a topic that first seemed just amazing. Authored by Riot Cumming on July 29th, 549 replies, 108 flags. Thread is titled, "Another NASA Employee Comes Forward, 8 to 9 foot Alien Sighted." And he opens the thread, "This is unbelievable news and should really be in the breaking news forum. Clark McClellan, a retired NASA space flight controller, has come forward in support of Dr. Edgar Mitchell. While on duty at the Kennedy Space Center, he observed for a minute on a TV monitor an 8 or 9 foot tall alien in the space shuttle loading bay when it was on a military mission. This is huge, huge news." And the thread goes on, and at first, you know, it's, wow, you know, NASA's flight controller, this seems like a really credible guy. But unfortunately, as things tend to happen in the UFO side of things and the thread developed, people remembered the thread on ATS from 2006 about Clark McClelland and his Stargate Chronicles website, stargate-chronicles.com. And this guy really does have an agenda about pushing UFOs. And, geez, one of the things you can do on his Stargate Chronicles website is buy from him some of his rare space memorabilia that he collected while he was at NASA. So, I mean, you know, this guy may believe that that's what he saw, but, you know, time and time again, unfortunately, when we get people stepping forward, you know, there does end up being some, you know, terrible credibility issues in their background. And in this case, as the thread progressed, it got actually kind of nasty in a couple unfortunate occasions. But, yeah, there are some real credibility concerns with someone that initially seemed like, wow, this guy's a former NASA flight controller. This will be great.
Right.
So basically that's how that thread panned out.
I wonder if some of the memorabilia that he's selling might include some NASA underwear. Because after reading this, I almost feel like I need a pair.
Yeah, soiled, right?
Yes.
It's mainly badges and rings. I'm looking at it now and some photographs and plaques and things
any
like that.
Any nudies? Any nudies, Bill?
I haven't found out yet, but if there are nudies, it would certainly be of the astronauts. So,
okay.
Because there's a lot of science.
Did they have any chicks on that particular mission? Do you remember?
There's not been that many chicks in space. So that was a movie, wasn't it? Chicks in Space?
Chicks in Space! By the way, we want to remind everybody that when we're talking about an 8 to 9 foot alien being sighted in the shuttle, we're not talking about a Latino that crossed over the border.
Yeah, well, that would be, he's on the Olympic basketball team now.
That's right.
It's been picked right up.
Yes. I've gone to the rabbit dark side again.
Moving right along.
Yes.
The next thread, popular this week, shifts gears to the international situation, and posted by Dimensional Detective. He's created a lot of great threads. 292 replies, 30 flags, posted on July 30th. U.S. Intel. Iran plans nuclear strike on U.S. And what we have here is a thread that begins in the news forum, sourced from Newsmax. Iran has carried out missile tests for what could be a plan for a nuclear strike on the United States. The head of a national security panel has warned. Now, come on. Iran is suddenly going to have the capability of intercontinental ballistic missiles? This seems like just more fear-mongering from...
Exactly. Much less, you know, planning a strike on the U.S. If there was any truth at all in this, don't you think that it would be Israel that would be the one that they should be concerned about?
You would think, but it just seems like there's just more fear-mongering noise. This is from the House Armed Services Committee testimony, and it's just crazy, the kind of stuff that's coming out of Washington to get the population ready for another action in another Gulf state.
How quickly we forget the Iraq. Weapons of mass destruction.
Mass destruction?
Thank you. I kind of blurted that out really bad.
No, that's,
weapons of mass destruction. Thank you.
No, I like the first one, John. It's
yeah.
More plausible. Yeah.
No, actually, you know, that does seem like, that's almost a Baghdad Bob kind of qualification. You know, that's sort of what he did. He's mass destruction. That was the guy who just...
I love that Baghdad Bob character.
He was good at his job.
Wasn't that a McDonald's toy? I think that was a McDonald's toy, wasn't it, Bill?
That was the Hamburglar.
Oh, I thought it was Baghdad Bob. Okay, sorry.
No, there were takeoffs on Baghdad Bob as the Hamburglar, a couple YouTube videos, which probably...
Yeah,
which
I saw that. Yeah.
And folks, we'll be here all week.
Right. Boy, I got to carry you guys every week, don't I?
Yeah, it sucks, doesn't it, Bill?
Yeah.
Now you know how our guests feel, Bill.
You know? Speaking of guests, hey, what a segue.
What a great segue.
The next thread is regarding someone we talked about just last week and we all really like and admire. It's about Jesse Ventura. Posted on July 29th by Golden Fleece, 287 replies, 34 flags. Former Navy SEAL and demolitions expert Jesse Ventura says the U.S. government carried out 9/11. And what it is, it's a link to a YouTube video where Jesse is indeed talking about the 9/11 inside job topics on the Howard Stern show just recently, just last week. And he does carry on with most of the more salient points about 9/11 and the inside job action. And it's certainly good to hear someone like Jesse stepping out and bringing these things up. His point of view was definitely more from the standpoint that these things don't make sense and we need to look at it more closely.
Yeah.
Right.
He wasn't screaming with the, let's say, conviction of some of the 9/11 truthers scream and was trying to have a more sober discussion, which was good to hear.
Yeah, and you know, the thing, and this will be real short, but you know, the thing that Johnny and I both love about Jesse is that, you know, he gives you the facts based upon his expertise in demolition, and you know, he says, okay, well, here's the facts, and you know, that's why I believe this. And I mean, you know, you can't argue mathematics. I'm sorry, you know, you can't argue mathematics. You can't argue, you know, all the square roots and all the other things that have to do with the way things fall to the earth. You know, Isaac Newton and all those guys, they must have had something going on because obviously they were right. So anyway.
Okay.
What?
That was great.
That was fantastic.
Sorry.
It was, talk about a bell curve. There was.
Well, hell, you know.
But somehow or another, you brought it right back to your point. So that's all that matters.
I'm sorry.
No, that was awesome. I mean, really.
It was. I love the mathematical innuendos.
It was pure golden Dave Rabbit. We were sitting and experiencing firsthand a pure, unadulterated, honest Dave Rabbit moment. It's historic. It's epic. It's poetic is what it is.
That's going to be in the year review shot.
Wow. That was great. That was really, oh, that was perfect. Anyway.
Yeah, get your stretchy rulers. We'll figure this one out, babe. Sorry. What about conspiracies, Bill?
Yeah, this is good. Quickly moving through some of the remaining threads, just a horrible story became popular in the news. But horror as bus passenger beheaded, posted by Looking In, 237 replies, Six Flags. Just a lot of people commenting on how just this person on the bus, where was this, where did this actually happen? I'm looking at the news article here. Do you guys recall where this happened? I just read on in the thread, but anyway, it's in the States, and it was an event where a guy just snapped on the bus and started stabbing and beheading the guy next to him. So it was just it happened in Toronto. I'm looking at the story now. So just a weird item coming out of Canada.
40 stab wounds.
Yeah, and one.
I think
big
he's
one.
Dead, Jim.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
But the other, and then the
wait a minute, who the hell's Jim? Who the hell's Jim?
That was my Bones impression from Star Trek. You know, they'd always go, "How's he look, Bones?" He's dead, Jim. That's all he would say. You know, he'd always been over to you. Try to use
Jim?
He'd
it
use a different.
He,
Jim was James Kirk.
I know.
The other Dave Rabbit moment was much better.
I'm a surgeon, not a backstabber.
Yeah, right.
Sorry.
But again,
I know we're short for time, but can I make one comment about this bus passenger thing?
Oh, certainly.
I noticed in the post that he said that the guy was quietly sitting next to him listening to music on the headphones. I just had one comment. Say, obviously, he didn't like what he was listening to.
Yeah, clearly. That's he didn't like the Eagles or something or whatever was being played.
Something set Inya. This guy off. I mean, Jesus. You know?
He was listening to Inya.
And now it's time for an exclusive announcement. And now here is one of the owners of AboveTopSecret.com, the Skeptic Overlord. Yes, Bill.
Well, so have you guys seen the thread that actually started a while ago? Because we were teasing people in an evil way beginning almost 2 months ago. The thread titled Hidden Link at Bottom of Page, What is the Conspiracy.com?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that thread began in June. And here it is already August, but what we did is we planned to start a game, and a lot of times the games that we do, we say, well, sometimes finding the game is part of the game, and that was indeed part of the aspect here. Beginning on August 8th, the game will start in earnest, where members who play the game, actually anyone can play the game, you don't have to be a member, will have to solve 10 puzzles based on cryptograms and other evil things that we've tossed into the mix. Post the answers rather to the questions that are posed by the puzzles after they solve them. It's actually quite complex, and then each correct answer reveals a little piece to another puzzle that again they have to solve to win the grand prize. So it's going to be really interesting to watch this play out. We've already put up sort of some relatively simple practice puzzles that has caused some consternation and hair loss apparently by some of the members as they scratch their head.
Yeah, I've been watching that one.
There. But
they've been getting very creative too. I've read probably about, I don't know, 4 or 5 pages worth, and these guys are getting into it. I mean, everything from, you know, trying to decrypt it with the use of Braille to it was just amazing.
Somebody actually wrote software.
Yeah.
To match the patterns that they see in the puzzles that we're putting up there. So that's going to be really interesting to see how well his software works on the real puzzles, which I can guarantee are most of them are much harder than what they've been working on.
And Bill, tell them what they can win!
Yes, Johnny.
Well, Johnny. Oh, sorry.
Each of the people who win or solve the individual 10 puzzles will get a custom t-shirt. We're putting together a absolutely custom design. You can't buy it anywhere else. The only way to get this t-shirt is essentially to win one of those 10 questions.
So they're collector's items.
Yeah, a limited edition ATS t-shirt. It's actually screen printed. This isn't something from Cafe Press where it's,
or Walmart.
No, we're using 500 wash quality screen print ink, I should say, on this thing with a heavy-duty 50-50 cotton t-shirt, the best we can buy at the shop that we're using. And it's actually local to me here, so I can go and approve them before they actually do the final ones. So we're making sure that these are the best quality. And the grand prize winner will get something that will be valuable to any ATS member.
An alimony check?
Wouldn't that be nice?
Sorry.
Now, for those of us who are not like Dave Rabbit and are concerned about our security and our privacy, the Iron Key, if you do a search on the Iron Key, it is the ultimate in data and web privacy and security. It's a USB drive that stores up to 4 gigabytes of data in an ultra-secure manner. So secure that you need a password to access it, and if someone steals your key and tries to access your data and they type in the password wrong 10 times, it literally self-destructs.
It's like a Mission Impossible deal.
Yes.
Just like
and if it detects that somebody tries to cut it open, it self-destructs.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
very cool.
What
happens if, you know, like somebody swallows it, Bill?
Well, then you'll have to just wait, is essentially what it is. It's a USB thumb drive.
Oh, okay. All right,
so. And so you just plug it into your computer. What the beauty of this is if you go to different internet cafes and use public computers quite a bit, you can literally keep all your programs and your web browser in an encrypted way on this key. You plug it in, and it has a hardened version of Firefox on there so that you can browse the web in an ultra-secure and ultra-private way, even if you're using somebody else's computer.
Wow.
So that's a really positive attribute to this. So it is a incredibly good piece of data privacy, especially as we hear more and more about how now the TSA feels that they can take your electronics as you come into the country from other countries.
Wow.
Have you heard about that story?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I've heard rumors about it.
So if you
but here's my question. You know, I mean, so they get this Iron Key thing. It is the big prize, right?
That's the grand prize. That's correct.
Okay, and then they each get. There's only going to be 10 of these shirts that are made. Period.
Well, 11. There'll be 11 shirts. Yeah, well, because the grand prize winner will also get a shirt.
Also, there's one grand prize winner and 10 runner-ups, right?
That's right.
Well, do each of them win the Iron Key?
No, the Iron Key is just for the grand prize winner.
Okay,
that's why they call it grand prize.
Yeah. All right, what did the other 10 guys win, or girls?
A T-shirt.
A shirt. All right, now, did you tell them, Bill, that on the front of it says, you know, I'm one of the 10 winners from the ATS game, and then on the back of it, it's a reproduction of the Dave Rabbit official sweatshirt? Did you tell them that?
Well, no, we're still working on the design, and that'll be revealed on Friday when we...
But you are going to put the Dave Rabbit official sweatshirt on the back, though, right?
Well, yeah, we'll do our best to fit that in. You might have to get up real close to read it, but it'll be there. I'll point it out to you.
I have come to the conclusion, Dave Rabbit, you are a publicity whore.
I am a publicity whore.
You are a publicity whore.
Either that or there's 10 gallons of open paint thinner in that apartment.
Well, as exciting as this is, we have to conclude it now. So just real quick here, Bill, if they want to play the game, whereabouts or howabouts would they begin?
On beginning Friday morning, they just go to www.whatistheconspiracy.com. That's all you got to do. It's very simple to play. You just solve the puzzle and type in your question.
Yeah, he said with an evil laugh.
Yeah, very simple to play my buttocks.
Just briefly, would you say that this may be one of the hardest games that has been developed?
Well, that's hopefully yes. This will be our fourth game. And the first one was rather difficult. And the next two had some really difficult moments. Actually, no, I think this is our sixth game actually now. But really, this time we're learning from the past and trying to devise something that's clearly not impossible. I want for anybody who's playing the game and hears this part of the podcast, here's a bit of a hint that will help some people.
Uh-oh.
There really is a discernible pattern if you know where to look that will help you solve each and every one of the puzzles. But actually, I also will reveal that most of the puzzles that we put out, the solutions for those were little tidbits and hints and pieces of information that will give the players not so much a head start, but sort of just get them focused in the right direction.
Right.
And while they've come pretty close on two solutions, they've made some critical errors that have caused them to reach the wrong conclusion. Mm-hmm. So I'll leave it at that, and they can go back and recheck the solutions they've applied.
Very good. And how long will the game last?
Until it's over.
Okay.
Yeah. Mark and I have a bet on this, and I think it's going to go.
Oh, is
longer.
It a pool? Is it a pool?
We could have a pool. We should have a cosmic pool on this.
Can
game.
We have a cosmic pool?
I think we should.
Okay, cosmic pool, because I paid attention to the last two, and I know it was pretty fast, I thought. It was amazing.
As fascinating as this is, it's time for us to conclude this segment with the Skeptic Overlord. And, of course, we want to thank you, Bill, and then, of course, Dave, who is in dial-up hell. And we'll look forward to having you back on next week here at the ATS Mix.
Nothing will match this historic show. This really was a moment that we all shared together tonight.
Yeah, it was a moment.
I feel closer already.
A group hug.
ATS Mix featured interview.
Well, Dave, I'm sure that you are probably still away doing your personal little investigation, are you not?
I very much am, John. Yeah, thanks for asking, though.
You know, this is kind of a second red-letter day for ATS Mix, because we're being able to bring back with us a gentleman that we interviewed not too long ago, and he agreed to come back for a part two of our interview with him. And, of course, I'm talking about Dr. Michio Kaku. Let me just tell you again for our listeners who may not have got a chance to listen to part one, which, by the way, if you have not, you need to go listen to that interview so that you'll kind of get an idea of where we're at in this interview. Dr. Kaku is an internationally recognized authority in theoretical physics and, of course, the environment. He holds just scads of awards. His books, everything that he's done is considered to be required reading at universities. He graduated from Harvard in 1968, summa cum laude. He was number one in his physics class. His goal was to help complete Einstein's dream of theory of everything, a single equation, perhaps no more than 1 inch long, which would help unify all the fundamental forces in the universe. He is best known, of course, for his segment that he did on the movie What the Bleep Do We Know, but you've seen him in scads of TV programs. He's on the History Channel, the Discovery Channel all the time. I know anytime I'm scanning through the channels and I see him, I stop to listen to what he's talking about. And the cool thing about our guest is he sets everything in a way that even the layman can understand what's going on. Some of the books that he's authored include Physics of the Impossible, Parallel Worlds, Hyperspace, Visions, and Einstein's Cosmos. His website is located at www.mkaku.org, and that's mkaku.org. And, of course, his books are available through Amazon.com and just about everywhere that you could find books sold at. It's an honor to have us again with us, Dr. Michio Kaku. Hello, Doctor. How are you?
Very good. Well, it's nice to have you, Doc. I've got a question before we kind of get into things. And okay. By the way, everybody just thought the world of your first show, and just we had amazing numbers, just like we did on the questions for you. So kudos mm-hmm. for that. You know, in our very first show, you know, Johnny asked you about some of your earlier projects, like when you were a kiddo, and you talked about building this device, and it had such magnetism that it was capable of pulling people's teeth out, their dentures. So I'm wondering, you know, after everybody got mad at you because their teeth were flying into your garage, what was maybe the next thing that you tried tackling when you were a kiddo?
Well, when I was a kid, I wanted to experiment with antimatter. In fact, I succeeded. I was able to get radioactive sodium-22, put it in a cloud chamber, hit it with a magnetic field, and identify tracks of antimatter inside my mom's garage. But then I wanted to produce my own beam of antimatter, and that's why I built the particle accelerator. And I'm very glad to say that the very same physics is now being used in the Large Hadron Collider, which will be turned on in August. The largest machine of science ever conceived of. It's basically a scaled-up version of what I was doing when I was in high school.
How large was that particle collider that you built?
The one I built, well, it weighed 400 pounds, contained 22 miles of copper wire. It was about like 4 feet by 4 feet, a pretty good chunk of metal that was inside, made out of transformer steel, copper wire, glass. It was a pretty big contraption, and I went to the National Science Fair with my science fair projects, talking about antimatter and looking at subatomic particle physics, and that's where I met Edward Teller, you know, father of the hydrogen bomb, when I was at Albuquerque, New Mexico, at the National Science Fair.
And so, obviously, nobody blew up on your block.
No one blew up on my block, that's right. The machine is safe. It just requires an enormous amount of power. I would blow out every circuit breaker in the house because it consumes 6 kilowatts of power. But that's what I did when I was in high school.
Sure.
It's not like putting a hairdryer into a local socket. It was a lot more dynamic than that, I would imagine.
Yes, it would literally blow out every single circuit breaker in the house. I had to be very careful to preserve the fuses and the circuit breakers in the house, or else my mother would scream at me.
Yeah,
the lights are out again.
I was just going to say, you must have been, as a child, one of those that your mother probably preferred not knowing what you were up to.
Yeah, she didn't know what the hell I was doing in the garage. She just knew that the lights would flicker, that the power would be gone. She just knew that there was crackling sound and fumes coming out of the garage. Other than that, she didn't know what I was doing.
How old were you when you made your particle collider?
I started this when I was about 16, and I finished it when I was 17. In fact, my parents were very helpful. You know, 22 miles of copper wire bonded on the high school football field. I would put the wire on the goalpost. I would give it to my mother. She'd run to the 50-yard line. She would give the wire to my father, and he would run to the other goalpost. And that's how we wound 22 miles of copper wire on the high school football field over Christmas.
Where on earth does somebody get 22 miles of copper wire, and the cost factor alone must have been enormous?
Well, you know, I went to Westinghouse, and they had tons of scrap metal, scrap transformer steel, wire. I went to Varian Associates. I grew up in Palo Alto, which is now Silicon Valley.
Right.
But even back then, there were a few electronics companies, and so I was able to knock on the doors of the various electronics companies to get the various components that I needed. Stanford University was not too far away, so as a high school kid, I would go to Stanford and read up everything on atom smashers and how to build a particle accelerator.
Wow, that's just incredible. Now that something that large had to draw some attention.
Yeah, it did. And like I said, Edward Teller made sure that I got a scholarship to Harvard, and that set me off on my career. Before that, I would talk to people, and they wouldn't know what the hell I was doing. At Harvard, I would talk to physicists who knew exactly what I was doing.
Right.
I didn't have to explain it to them. And they took one look at my machine, and they said, oh, yes, Kurtz Betatron. They knew exactly what I was doing. So,
wow.
And that set me off on my career.
Incredible. Well, you know, we had a chance to find out quite a bit about some of your passions in part one of the interview, but I thought we would continue with that. What are some of the things that are garnering your interest right now? What are the things that really got your mind going in all sorts of different directions?
Well, you know, in my book, Physics of the Impossible, I summarize some of the really mind-boggling developments taking place in the world of physics that's making what we call science fiction come true. For example, invisibility. I used to teach optics to my class here at the college and tell them that invisibility defied the laws of physics. I would give the equations and say, see, invisibility is impossible. Well, 2 years ago, I was proven wrong, and so was every physicist on the planet Earth. At Duke University, they were able to show that you can actually bend light in a way consistent with invisibility. And now at Caltech and also at the University of Karlsruhe in Germany, they're showing that visible light, not just microwaves, but visible light can bend in a way consistent with invisibility. So what happens is light hits you and light wraps around you and then reforms at the other end. It's like a boulder in a river. Water hits a boulder, wraps around the boulder, and reforms at the other end.
Right.
That was supposed to be impossible for light. Water does it, but light can't. Well, we did it. And it's funded by the United States Pentagon. They're not stupid. They know the enormous implications of what happens if you can make things invisible.
Right.
Now, we don't expect to get large objects invisible anytime soon. This is still in the laboratory. We're doing it on a microscopic scale. But the proof of principle has been demonstrated. So, Harry Potter, watch out.
Well, it is kind of along the same lines, Doctor, of the professed Philadelphia experiment?
Somewhat, except the Philadelphia experiment was based on a movie. There's a movie about that experiment. And, you know, I haven't been able to get any documentation on it. And the amount of energy necessary to open up a gateway or a hole in space is the Planck energy, the energy of a black hole. So it would be very difficult for people during World War II to create a device that even today we cannot duplicate. But right in the laboratory now, we're able to show that objects can disappear if you shine microwave radiation on it. And visible light was shown to be consistent with invisibility just a few months ago. So this is a very fast-moving field right now. So in my book, Physics of the Impossible, I talk about a lot of what you see in the movies that you kind of like shake your head, scratch your head after the movie, and you wonder, is any of that possible? Like teleportation. Teleportation used to be considered totally outside the realm of physics. We used to laugh at it, in fact, I still remember. But now we can teleport subatomic particles. We can't teleport Captain Kirk yet, but we regularly teleport particles of light. The world's record is about 100 miles. We can teleport photons about 100 miles. Next, we're going to teleport particles of light up to the space shuttle and then to the moon. We'll be back to the moon after 2020, and we're asking NASA to allow us to set up a teleportation experiment. And we now can teleport individual atoms. Cesium, brilliant atoms, were teleported just a few years ago. And I suspect that we'll be able to teleport like carbon dioxide, simple molecules in a few years. And after that, maybe even DNA. Maybe after that, maybe even part of a cell. This is well within the realm of possibility. And so this is another area that was once considered totally impossible, but now is moving at breakneck speed.
Many folks are trying to create what they call a space elevator. So something like that would obviously make that obsolete.
That's right. A space elevator is yet another technology that I talk about in my book. If you have a ball on a string, you know that if you spin the ball does not fall down. Now, that's because centrifugal force counteracts the force of gravity.
Right.
Well, the Earth spins. Therefore, if you get a big enough ball and let the ball spin around the Earth, then the ball never falls. And you just do a simple calculation. We give it to our physics students. You can calculate that the tension on the string would exceed the strength of steel. That's why historically it was considered a curiosity, the fact that a space elevator is within the realm of physics. But now we have carbon nanotubes. And carbon nanotubes are much stronger than steel, and you just put it into the equations, and you find out that carbon nanotubes can sustain a space elevator. So this has generated yet another stampede, because the cost of launching something into outer space is so expensive, it's prohibitive. It costs $10,000 a pound to put anything into orbit around the Earth. That's your weight made out of solid gold.
Right.
Imagine John Glenn or you made out of solid gold.
Right.
That's
mm-hmm.
the price of what it takes for you to go into outer space.
Wow.
With a space elevator, we think we can get that down by a factor of 100. So, you know, instead of $10,000 a pound, maybe $10 a pound to put you into orbit.
Well, you know, Doctor, it's interesting. In our first show with you, part one, and again, I want to remind all the members to be sure and go and listen to the doctor's interview of part one, because it's got some amazing things in there. But we talked about frequencies, Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a conversation with a good friend of ours, George Knapp, who with Colm Kelleher wrote a book called The Hunt for the Skinwalker. And there is a being that they have seen. And when we mentioned to George Knapp about the possibilities of, and we mentioned that we had talked to you about frequencies, he was very, very interested in and really had some high anticipation of what that possibly could be about that. And I'm just wondering, were you familiar with any of the work that Colm Kelleher and George Knapp did on the Hunt for the Skinwalker?
No. What is that? The Hunt for what?
John, can you give the doctor a little bit of information about it?
Sure. Of course, you already know about the National Institute for Discovery Sciences, and Colm Kelleher was the director for that. Robert Bigelow, the billionaire Robert Bigelow, bought a ranch where there has been enormous amount of paranormal activity going on in Utah. And supposedly it's been going on for literally hundreds of years. There's even Indian lore that goes back thousands of years about that whole area. And so Robert Bigelow employed some of the greatest scientists to come there and take on these paranormal activities in a scientific mode. So they didn't want to have conjecture or best guess theories. They wanted to try to find the science in it. And they were finding that they were having to really look out of the box, because as they were trying to videotape these events that were going on, their batteries would drain and it would disable them being able to continue the experiment. So they had to go do like manual cameras. Everything had to go manually for them to be able to document any of these activities that were happening. Some of these activities included like luminous, they called them luminous tunnels or holes that would seem to be levitated over the ground by several feet, and supposedly a creature of some sort coming out of it. The only thing is, they could not see it in the normal spectrum, so they were using infrared, Generation 3 military goggles, to be able to observe this and document it. So I'm sure where Dave was alluding to was, had you heard of anything, you talked about last interview about the frequencies and how we may not actually even know that there is somebody else in our studio right now, but they are operating at a different frequency. And so I think that might have been what you were alluding to. Is that not right,
Dave?
You're
correct, John.
Let me explain. When we teach quantum theory to our students, we tell our students that everything is vibrating and everything has wave-like properties, and the wave equation is given by Schrodinger. And these waves overlap with each other, and because they overlap with each other, you can have electrons being two places at the same time, and you can have electrons disappearing, reappearing someplace else. Now, of course, that sounds impossible. How can something be two places at the same time? And the way you can have that is you have the wave function, that is the wave of the electron overlapping, and also splitting apart. You've seen ocean waves. Ocean waves can hit a barrier, and you get two ocean waves as a consequence.
Right.
Well, in quantum mechanics, we think that when there's a juncture, perhaps the universe splits in half. And the one universe goes one way, the other universe goes the other way, and one quantum event splits a universe in half. Now, you may say to yourself, well, where did the other universe go? It didn't go anywhere. It occupies the same space. Just like two ocean waves that overlap with each other, they are decoherent. They no longer vibrate in unison. We call this decoherence theory. So that's how you can get two electrons being two places at the same time. Now, of course, when we take a look at big objects, we don't see big objects doing this. We don't see ordinary people splitting in half and one going to the left, one going to the right. But it does happen at the subatomic level. In fact, that's called electronics. Electronics would be impossible without the electron being many places at the same time simultaneously. The simplest example of this is a laser beam. Okay, laser beams would be impossible if we didn't have the fact that electrons can be two places at the same time. So why don't big people experience this every day? And the reason is we have decohered from the other universe. We no longer vibrate in phase. At the subatomic level, it's very easy to get electrons to decohere and still mix because they're very tiny. The wavelengths are very small. We're very big, and we consist of trillions upon trillions of electrons. And therefore, when we separate from our counterpart, it means that it's very difficult to recombine with it again. Because we have separated from it, we're no longer in phase. Like a radio, you can't tune into one frequency and tune into the other frequency at the same time. You only can tune into one frequency at any given time. But this is the latest theory, the theory of the multiverse, the fact that the universe does seem to be splitting apart every moment of the day, which, of course, as I mentioned before, means that people that have died in our universe probably still live in another universe, which has split apart from our universe.
That's wow. That's mind-blowing. One more quick question before we get into our member questions, and that is it possible for our magnetic fields, the Earth, in whatever hundred thousands of years that it may have taken for it to happen, is it possible for the poles to shift? And if so, what would that do to the magnetic fields for us as humans?
Well, the magnetic field of the Earth is decreasing with time. You can actually measure this. And within a few centuries to millennia, it will, in fact, collapse. And we know this. We know the fact that the poles do shift by simply going to Hawaii. You go to Hawaii and you drill right into the lava flows. When lava freezes, that is, when it cools down, the direction of the magnetic north is frozen into the little magnets inside the lava, because, of course, lava has iron in it. And as you drill into the lava flows, you find out that every few feet or so, the North Pole shifts. All of a sudden, you know, you go several feet, the North Pole is in one direction, and you go to another layer, and boom, all of a sudden, the North Pole has gone to another area. And you can calculate that it takes thousands of years for the poles to shift. And we seem to be entering such a period now. The magnetic field of the Earth is half a Gauss. That's the strength of the magnetic field. By comparison, when you go to have your MRI scan done, you're hit with about 20,000 times the Earth's magnetic field. And that's also the magnetic field of my machine. My machine also produced about 20,000 Gauss. But anyway, the Earth's magnetic field is half a Gauss, but it's weakening. If you go back to old records of 100 years ago and then compare that today, you find that it's measurably gotten weaker. And so, yeah, it means that the Earth's magnetic field may be about to shift again. But again, these shifts take place over centuries to millennia.
So it's not going to be anything drastic or quick.
Just judging from the past, that is, if you drill into the lava flow and look at how the transitions were done, you find that the poles are pretty stable for millions of years, and then all of a sudden it flips. And we're not even sure why. You see, magnetic currents are created by electrical currents. Inside the Earth, we have magma with iron in it. So electricity is moving inside the Earth. And as a consequence, that creates the Earth's magnetic field. That's how magnetic fields are created, by the circulation of electrons. So electrons circulating inside the Earth creates the Earth's magnetic field. But we don't know the structure of the Earth. The Earth is a big black box. As a consequence, we don't know exactly which currents are producing the magnetic field of the Earth. This is one of the big unknowns of science. But we do know that it is periodic, and we do know that it will flip. And we know that it's going to flip in the not-too-distant future.
One more.
Well, as long as it doesn't flip while we're doing this interview, Doc, that's all we care about.
When it flips, by the way, the magnetic field of the Earth protects us from cosmic radiation. If you go to the North Pole, you see, for example, the aurora borealis, the northern lights. That's because the northern lights are basically solar radiation from the sun that spirals down the North Pole. But the North Pole is not stable. So when the magnetic field is about to shift, the magnetic field goes to zero, and then we're going to be hit with lots of cosmic radiation from outer space.
I'm sorry, Dave. I got one more quick one because he opened up a door here. Do you have any thoughts about, you were just discussing how we really don't know what the Earth is comprised of and as we go deeper. Do you think there's any chance that there could be the possibility of a hollow Earth?
Well, we physicists have actually looked at that. We know how much the Earth weighs, believe it or not. We know this because of Newton's laws of gravity. Newton's equations have within it the mass of the Earth, the mass of the Sun. And we have space probes that we shoot out, and these space probes are accurate to one part in like 10 billion. So we have, with very good accuracy, an understanding of the mass of the Earth, and in fact, the mass of the Sun. We couldn't launch space probes unless we knew the mass of the Sun. Now, we know the density of rock. We know how much rock there is. We know the density of rock. And you just multiply, and you find that the numbers agree. So this means that the Earth is probably solid, because we know the mass of the Earth. We know the density of rock. We know how much rock there is. And you do the calculation, and it matches. Now, that doesn't mean there can't be pockets down there. But the mass of the Earth seems to agree that it is pretty solid. Now, however, if you have a pocket down there, gravity does get weaker as you go toward the center of the Earth. And in fact, if you hit the center of the Earth, gravity goes to zero, because, of course, you're perfectly symmetrical, so gravity can't point anywhere.
Right.
So gravity does get weaker as you go toward the center of the Earth.
Yeah, and that's interesting because, you know, Jules Verne and several of the science fiction guys have always purported, you know, in their books and stuff that, you know, a possibility of someone going to the center of the Earth. And so basically that would be almost a theoretic impossibility, would it not?
It'd be very difficult. Well, you can calculate how much pressure would be placed on the rock. If you had a cave down there, the cave would have to be pretty strong to withstand the weight of the rock above you that
right.
pushes down, that would collapse any gaps. So if there are any gaps, they would have to be pretty close to the surface of the Earth. If you have a gap pretty far down, the gravity of the rock above you would be sufficient to crush you.
Remind me, John, we never want to go to the center of the Earth.
Okay.
All right. Well, you know, as you stated in our first interview with you, Doctor, the members of AboveTopSecret.com are pretty astute. In fact, some of them are so astute that Johnny and I really had a problem with some of the questions. But we want to get started because there's a lot of interesting questions, and I think you're really going to have a lot of fun with some of these.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to start with member Argus, and he says, Doctor, in your honest opinion, do you think we as a race, with all of the negative forces at work on our planet, ever reach stage two of civilization, and do you think we as a race will ever be able to travel to the stars?
Well, I tend to be cautiously optimistic. I think we are about 100 years from being what is called a Type 1 civilization. A Type 1 civilization is truly planetary. They can control the weather. They can control the course of hurricanes. And if you take a look at, you know, what's happening in the Earth today, there are two trends. One trend is toward chaos, nuclear proliferation, threat of war, biogerms, and global warming. But on the other hand, we do have the trend toward a planetary civilization, a Type 1 civilization. As I mentioned, English will be the language of Type 1. The European Union is the beginning of a Type 1 economy. We also have the beginning of a Type 1 culture, rock music, blue jeans, rock and roll. The Internet is the beginning of a Type 1 telephone system. So it's not clear which trend will win out because the Earth is heating up much faster than anyone expected. If you look at the literature 10 years ago, they mentioned global warming, but their estimates were way off. The Earth has heated up much faster than any of the worst-case scenarios mentioned just 10 years ago, if you go back to the literature. However, going to the stars now, I think by the end of this century, we'll probably send the first probe to a nearby star.
Wow.
Some different types of designs are mentioned in my book, Physics of the Impossible. One of the most ingenious designs that I've seen is to, instead of sending Captain Kirk to a star, send tiny little needles, nanotechnology, nanoships. Nanoships would be very easy to accelerate near to the speed of light because they're very tiny. And they would have a computer inside of tremendous power. And you send billions of them, not just one, you send billions of them to a nearby star, and maybe only a handful make it. But that's okay, because each little needle is equipped with a supercomputer on board. Another possibility is fusion. The ramjet fusion reactor is perhaps the most promising. The ramjet fusion reactor looks like an ice cream cone. It scoops up hydrogen in the forward direction and then burns the hydrogen in its fusion reactor, and so you have unlimited fuel. This starship will run forever. You just turn it on, and it just accelerates near the speed of light forever. So the ramjet fusion reactor is another possibility, but we have to master the art of fusion first. And we're going to be doing that in France. The French and the Europeans and the United States and Japan are putting up $10 billion to build the world's first operating fusion reactor in southern France. And so we think that it will achieve break-even. It's going to be turned on around 2020, and we think it'll produce more energy than it consumes, and it will run on seawater.
Wow.
And we have tons of seawater out there, much more than oil, of course, and seawater is the basic fuel for the fusion reactor. So we think that by mid-century, probably by 2040, when we commercialize this technology, that will enter the fusion era. The danger period, though, is between now and the next 40 years. What do we do between now and the next 40 years as the Earth heats up, as we run out of oil, as we try to phase out fossil fuels? That's a danger period. But I think if we can make it to the next, to mid-century, I think fusion will kick in, and it will use fusion to energize the world and perhaps even go to the stars.
Wow.
The question is, can we make it?
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
Well, those sound like those would be exciting times to live in. Our next member is named Dr. Felixer. I'm hoping I pronounced that name correctly. And this is a hypothetical question for you, Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
If you were able to design an actual working time machine, would you do so with a Tipler cylinder in mind, one that might allow quantum gravity to be manipulated? And if it did actually work, what would be the first place that you would want to go to in it?
Okay, well, Frank Tipler, who is a colleague of mine, took an old solution of Einstein's equation by von Stockholm. Von Stockholm, around 1937, I think it was, imagined a cylinder, a maypole, that was spinning. And if you danced around this imaginary maypole that is infinitely long, you would come back before you left. So this is perhaps the first solution of Einstein's equations which allow for time travel. However, the universe does not rotate. We don't have any infinitely long maypoles. So these solutions are a little bit academic. However, since then, we have found hundreds of other solutions of Einstein's equations which do seem to allow for time travel. One of them is the black hole. It's, of course, dangerous to go into a black hole. No one's ever done that. But in principle, the mathematics says that a black hole could be a gateway to another space or another time. However, there's another solution that doesn't require a black hole, and it uses what is called the Casimir effect. The Casimir effect is real. We measured it in the laboratory. It's very tiny. But if an advanced civilization can harness enough negative energy, you can open up a gateway to another universe or a gateway to another time. So negative energy seems to be the most convenient way to build a time machine. But as I mentioned, it would take a very advanced civilization, probably type 3, before we can play with the Casimir energy to open up a gateway into the past. But if I had a time machine, where would I go? Well, one place I would like to go is perhaps witness the creation of the universe. Of course, that was quite dangerous back then. It's quite radioactive. But we hope to simulate a piece of the Big Bang outside Geneva, Switzerland, in a few weeks with the Large Hadron Collider. But if I had a time machine, I think I would like to witness the birth of the universe, assuming that I could be far away enough that I wouldn't be burned to a crisp when the universe...
Yeah, you wouldn't want to be ground zero, right, Doc?
Yeah. That'd be much, much greater than anything that a hydrogen bomb could produce.
Right.
All right, AboveTopSecret.com member Mitchell, and he says, randomness seems to be an unquestionable status, Doctor, and if it is a given, the dictionary says random means there is a set of possibilities where each possibility has an equal opportunity to occur. How does randomness establish a set, then create a possibility and an opportunity? So his question is, how does randomness endow a possibility with the ability to even occur?
Well, We physicists use the word entropy when we talk about randomness, chaos, and we can give it a number. We can actually calculate how much entropy there is, or randomness, or chaos in any given object. And as the gentleman pointed out, it's very difficult to reduce randomness. In fact, chaos always increases. Total entropy always increases in the universe. And then we're left with a mystery. If total entropy always increases, if things always rust, if things always decay, if things always fall apart and turn to dust, then why are we here? Well, that was the question that we had, that Darwin had to ask. Why do we have young children being born if entropy says that chaos rules, that chaos increases with time? That's the second law of thermodynamics. So Darwin came up with a theory of evolution. You see, there is one way to reduce randomness. As I said before, total entropy has to increase. Therefore, if you have a refrigerator, if you put your hand behind the refrigerator, it's hot.
Right.
It's quite hot behind the refrigerator. So inside the refrigerator, it's cold with low entropy, but behind the refrigerator, it's hot with lots of entropy. So the way to reduce entropy in your refrigerator is to increase it elsewhere. That's how you get around it. That's why evolution works on the planet Earth. I mean, why our brain, for example, is the most complex object probably in this sector of the Milky Way galaxy. If you think about it, what sits on your shoulder is the most complex object that Mother Nature has created, probably out to, 10, 50, maybe 1,000 light years. You probably have to go that far before you find another civilization with a brain as advanced as our brain. So by rights, the human brain should be impossible. So where does the heat go? In other words, if you reduce entropy in a refrigerator, you have to increase entropy elsewhere. And the answer is the sun. It turns out that we extract energy from the sun. That energy drives the burning of fuel, the working of a DNA molecule, and that's why we humans can exist at all, because we have energy from the sun. So total entropy does increase, though the Earth gets hot. Look at global warming. But we, our brain, has very low entropy as a consequence. Then we ask the other question, and this is the question for which we physicists begin to stutter and our face turns red. Where did the entropy of the sun come from? What about the universe? It turns out that our universe is quite ordered. We have intelligent life, i.e. us. We have stars, galaxies, we have encyclopedias, we have lots of order in our universe. Therefore, if entropy always increases, this means that our universe probably came from a state of very low entropy. The Big Bang had very low chaos in it. And chaos has been increasing ever since, but the instant of the Big Bang had low chaos. Now, why? Why should the universe have such low chaos? This is the $64,000 question. We don't know. We don't know why the universe had such low chaos. But if you think about it, the universe is quite strange. For example, it has equal positive charge and negative charge. The two charges cancel out exactly in our universe. The universe doesn't spin. If you calculate the spin of all the galaxies, it adds up to zero. So the universe has almost very little entropy, no spin, equal balance of positive and negative charges. And the only way to explain all of this is the fact that the universe probably came from nothing. The universe was probably a quantum fluctuation of nothing. Even the Bible mentions this, that the universe came out of the mist. In Buddhism, they call the mist nirvana. So we think that this nirvana is 10-dimensional hyperspace, and that 10-dimensional hyperspace was unstable. Little strings would vibrate in 10-dimensional hyperspace. And that's why the universe has no spin, the universe has no net charge, and the universe has no low entropy, because it basically came from nothing. Which means that our universe is a bubble that probably coexists with other bubbles out there. Our bubble is special, but it has intelligent life in it. Most of these other bubbles probably don't have intelligent life, but the idea of a multiverse has pretty much taken over most of physics now. Most of the research physicists believe that we exist in a multiverse. So to answer your question, why do we have chaos and why do we have humans? The reason why we have humans probably is because the universe came from nothing.
Member System IK, excuse me, asked this. Are you aware of the electric universe theory presented by David Talbot and Wallace Thornhill? And if so, what is your opinion of their work?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that theory. I've heard of many, many theories. People email me all their theories.
Right.
I've heard of plasma universes, holographic universes, but I haven't heard of the electric universe.
Okay.
That's something I haven't heard of.
All right, member Leo Strauss asked, Doctor, do you believe the laws of physics were violated by the official explanation of the collapse of the three World Trade Center towers?
Do I think the laws of physics were violated?
Yes.
No, I don't think the laws of physics have been violated. We measure the laws of physics every single day with our satellites to within about 1 part in 10 billion, and we see no deviation in the laws of physics as we measure them with our satellites. So I don't think you have to invoke any kind of new physics to explain tragedies. The Earth seems to run pretty well with the laws of physics.
Okay.
Well, I didn't realize until you, John, forgive me, I'm going to do a minor sidebar, but
sure.
I didn't even realize that there was a way that you could actually test that. How do you test the laws of physics, Doctor?
Oh, yeah, you can actually test the laws of physics. If one of the laws of physics were wrong, then the whole fabric of modern physics would collapse, and we'd have to go back to the drawing board. So physics is different from religion. In religion, you have exceptions all the time. In philosophy, we debate about exceptions. Physics tolerates no exceptions whatsoever. If there's one violation of Newton's laws of gravity within the solar system, any violation of Einstein's theory of special relativity beyond the solar system and at high velocities, one violation of the quantum principle, then we have to throw the whole thing out the window. Now, we do know that there are such violations. At the center of the Big Bang, Einstein's theory makes no sense. At the center of a black hole, Einstein's theory makes no sense. Therefore, we do know that you must have violations of Einstein's theory. But so far, we see no such violations. For example, the GPS system. We have a GPS satellite going around the Earth right now. It locates your position to within a few feet, right?
Right.
Well, one
right.
day, if the GPS system didn't work, we'd have to throw relativity out the window. Relativity makes possible the GPS system. Or the Internet. The Internet runs on laser beams. Laser beams use the quantum principle. And if the quantum principle were wrong, all hell would break loose. Your TV wouldn't work.
Right.
Lasers wouldn't work. The Internet wouldn't work. This phone conversation would disappear.
Right.
Right.
So we measure the laws of physics every day.
I'm with you. Okay, great. That put it in layman's terms. I appreciate that, Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
The member Son of PC asked this, have any of your theories on physics been influenced by personal experiences? Anything in your background to make you believe we live in a non-Einstein universe?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you take a look at Einstein's personal guiding principle, if you were to say what motivated him and what motivates us physicists, you can summarize it in one word, and that is unification. If you were to summarize his whole life, you know, forget all the anecdotes, forget equals MC squared, forget everything, right? One word summarizes what motivated him. Matter and energy, he unified them. He showed that matter can turn into energy, that's called an atomic bomb, and energy can turn into matter, and space and time. He showed that space and time can also be unified. What motivates me is to unify everything, the entire universe. It was Einstein who set off to create the unified field theory. He failed, mainly because he didn't understand the nuclear force. But today, we have understood, we do understand the nuclear force. We have what is called the quark model. We do understand the nuclear force. This is something that Einstein did not have. He didn't have the quark model. He didn't know what made up the proton or the neutron. So today, we have all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, but they don't fit together. We do have the quarks. We do have electricity. We do have light. What I do for a living, my day job, is to try to put all these pieces of the jigsaw together into a superforce that gives us gravity, light, electricity, magnetism. That's what motivates a whole generation of young physicists to find the superforce.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. Member Bunch says, Doctor, would you agree with the premise that if advanced
alien civilizations really did exist, we would at least see some of their work through the galaxy in the way of outer space infrastructure or some kind of space station or some kind of energy devices or the like?
Yeah, I've thought about that too. I mean, let's say we have a Type 3 civilization. This is a question that Carl Sagan asked himself. Let's say there's a Type 3 civilization in our backyard, in our sector of the Milky Way galaxy. Would we see, like, different stars moving in a formation? Would we see evidence of this Type 3 civilization in the night sky? He asked himself a question. Could we even detect the presence of a Type 3? And then he came up with a very depressing answer. And that answer is, we are so primitive. We couldn't even know there was a Type 3 civilization in our backyard because we're so stupid.
Yeah.
If you see an anthill and you go down to the ants, first of all, when you see an anthill, do you go down to the ants and say, I bring you trinkets, I bring you beads, I give you nuclear energy, take me to your leader? No, you step on a few of them. And if you build a 10-lane superhighway next to the anthill, would the ants even know there's a 10-lane superhighway being built by the workers? Would they be able to eavesdrop on the communication between the workers? Would the ants even know what a 10-lane superhighway is? Carl Sagan came to the conclusion that if we're ants and somebody's building a 10-lane superhighway next to us, we wouldn't even know what they were doing. We wouldn't know why they were building a 10-lane superhighway. We couldn't communicate with them. We didn't know their language. We didn't know their technology. But that's the difference between Type 0 and Type 3.
Wow.
A Type 3 civilization is much more advanced than Type 0 in the same way that we are more advanced than ants.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, what you're saying basically, John, forgive me for sidebarring again, but in essence, if I'm understanding you correctly, Doctor, what you're saying is that we're so primitive in our technology and our knowledge that even if we did see something, it wouldn't register with us because we wouldn't know what we were looking at to begin with?
Exactly.
Okay.
We could be staring in the face communications from advanced civilizations, and we wouldn't even know it because we are so primitive. In other words, when we look for signals from aliens in outer space, we listen to one frequency, just one frequency. Now, if ants were trying to listen to our frequencies on their ant antenna, they wouldn't pick up anything
because
they're listening to the wrong frequency. They're listening to the wrong set of radiation. The ants would be clueless as to what radiation to use to eavesdrop on our conversation. So we could be staring at alien civilizations and not even know it because there's nothing to compare it with.
Right.
Our technologies are so primitive, there's no reference system.
Yeah.
Wow.
A member by the name of Jamiros says this, I saw your documentary about immortality. I was very intrigued with the relation between time and biology with the experiments that you made at the beginning. What made you explore man's search for immortality, and then how far are we from this possibility exactly?
Well, BBC Television a few years ago needed a host to talk about some of the cutting-edge issues of science. And since then, these BBC documentaries have aired in the United States on the Discovery Channel and the Science Channel. And, oh, by the way, next month in August, I'll be hosting a three-hour series about the future of science. 1 hour on the future of robots and computers, 1 hour on the future of medicine, 1 hour on the quantum future, nanotechnology, and space travel, starting August 10th.
What channel will that be on?
Science Channel.
Okay.
Get your cable listings and find out if you can pick up the Science Channel.
Great.
And, so starting August 10th, three Sundays in a row, I'll be hosting a three-part series for BBC. Well, BBC originally had an idea for a four-part series about time. Biological time, personal time, cosmic time, geologic time. How do we measure time? How do we know what time is? When did time begin? When is time going to end? So one segment was cheating time. And by cheating time, that means a search for immortality. Now, when I was a kid, I read as much science as I could. And I realized, even as a child, something rather depressing, that in my lifetime, we would not discover the secret of the aging process and the secret of immortality. Because when I was a child, reading up on the aging process, I realized that we knew nothing, zero, nada. We didn't know anything about the aging process. Now we think we understand what the aging process is and how to reverse some of it, okay? What is aging? We now know what aging is. Aging is misinformation. It's entropy. It's our genetic code that gets errors in it. And the errors build up, and that's why cells don't begin to act properly. That's called aging. But we can now begin the process of cheating the aging process, which is what we talked about in this BBC special. They flew me down to North Carolina, where we're experimenting with the human body shop. You know, if you have a car accident, you go to the body shop and order new fenders and new parts, right?
Right.
In the future, we'll be doing that to our aging body. Right now, we can grow skin, bone, cartilage, heart valves, and bladders in the laboratory from your own cells.
Hmm.
The bladder has already been grown, and the liver will be grown perhaps within 5 years. And also the genes that control the aging process are also being teased apart. And so it is possible that our children may have an extended lifespan. Our kids may live to be far longer than we can possibly imagine.
Well, good riddance for them. That's all I got to say, Doc. They've been giving me crap for the last 20, 30 years. So I hope they have a long mortality so they can be a little bit of payback for everything they did when they grew up as kids. Remember Stanton Sagan. I wonder where he got that from. His question, Doctor, is, personally, what do you believe happens when you die? Is reincarnation in parallel universe a possibility?
Well, in our universe, we can talk about parallel universes in a second. In our universe, it does seem as if when you die, your molecules do fall apart. We would like to believe that there is some essence that is preserved after we die, and we scientists have looked for it. We've actually weighed people before death, after death, to see whether there's a soul. And some of the results are a little bit controversial, but most results show no change in weight. Before you die, after you die, there's no difference. So if there is a soul, it must be beyond atoms, because we cannot measure it with the measuring equipment that we have. However, that said, we also have counterparts in other universes. Like I said, just walking across the room, you go to the left, you go to the right. Well, somebody else went to the right and to the left, and you split. You split apart, and another parallel universe opened up. We have decohered from it. We no longer vibrate in unison with it. But yeah, there is another universe where you took a different path. You went to a different university. You married somebody different. You chose a different career. And you could be dead in one universe and alive in another. Now, this is not reincarnation, because it's the same you, but
right.
You exist in multiple states. So in some of these universes, you're already dead. In some of these universes, perhaps somebody will have discovered how to genetically reprogram the cell, and you're going to live an awful long time.
Mike Boyd, U.S., asks this, what is your view on the concept of synchronicity, and what do you think of the idea that the initial singularity still exists as a naked singularity somewhere in the cosmos?
Okay, well, let me define some terms, okay?
Okay.
First of all, singularity. Singularity is a point in space and time where we have infinite mass, infinite gravity, and that's what happened at the instant of the Big Bang. We call it a singularity because our equations break down at that point. Personally, I think that with string theory, we can eliminate the singularity and actually get finite results, measurable results, to analyze the singularity. And we'll be able to pick up radiation from what happened before the Big Bang. Now, in about 2015, we're going to be launching a satellite system called LISA into orbit to actually pick up radiation from the singularity and then go backwards in time to see what happened before the singularity was created. LISA consists of three satellites making a triangle in outer space connected by laser beams. These laser beams are 3 million miles long, making an equilateral triangle. At each joint of the triangle, we have a satellite. Any wave, any gravity wave from the instant of creation will hit this apparatus and jiggle the laser beam, and then give us information about gravity waves that are still circulating around the universe from the instant of creation itself. We're going to get baby pictures of the instant of creation.
Wow.
And then, by testing the radiation we get from the instant of creation, we'll be able to test many pre-Big Bang theories. Right now, many of my friends work on pre-Big Bang theories. String theory is finite, it's not infinite like Einstein's equations at the instant of the Big Bang. So string theory gives us alternate possibilities for what happened before the Big Bang. And so LISA should be able to experimentally rule out or rule in some of these theories that we physicists are working with. At the present time, there are two basic variations that we're looking at. One possibility is that our universe is a soap bubble that peeled off from a mother soap bubble, and we came from a baby soap bubble that then sprouted from another soap bubble. Another possibility being looked at Princeton is the collision of two soap bubbles. The collision of two soap bubbles could create enough energy to create something that looks like the Big Bang. A third possibility is that our universe came from nothing. Our universe, as I mentioned, has zero charge, zero spin, probably zero entropy when it got created. So that's consistent with a bubble popping out of existence, out of nothing.
Hmm.
So these are the theories of the singularity that we're looking at right now.
Hmm.
John, I think we only have time for one or two more questions. So I'm going to ask one, and I guess I'll let you finish up with the last one.
Okay.
Member Mike Singh, this is pretty interesting, Doctor, because you've already elaborated on what your beliefs is, but he has kind of a statement here that's kind of interesting. According to Stephen J. Crothers, Doctor, black holes are a myth. He claims that the concept has been conjured up by a combination of confusion, superstition, and ineptitude, and is sustained by widespread suppression of facts, both physical and theoretical. Are these statements unequivocally true, Doctor?
Well, first of all, let's define a black hole. Before we argue whether or not they exist, let's give a definition. Hollywood gives you a definition. Science fiction novelists give you a definition. But what is a definition? Very simple. A black hole is an object whose escape velocity is the speed of light. To escape a black hole, you have to go faster than the speed of light. Now, of course, you cannot go faster than the speed of light. So, therefore, nothing escapes. So that's the definition of a black hole. To escape it, you have to break the speed of light barrier, and you can't do that. Okay? Now, in outer space, in our own galaxy, if you look in the direction of Sagittarius, we see an object, a very, very large object. It weighs 3 million times or so the mass of our sun. You can calculate the escape velocity of that object. And what do you get? The speed of light. In fact, if you look at Andromeda, our nearest neighbor, you see the same thing. At the core, you see an object, in fact, two objects spinning around each other. And if you calculate the energy necessary to escape it, it is, again, you would have to break the light barrier to escape it. So by definition, we have black holes. It's not a question of theory. It's just a question of experiment. We measure these things. And how many of them are there? Thousands of them. They're gorgeous photographs, by the way, on NASA.gov of the accretion disk of a black hole. NGC 4258 is perhaps one of the most famous. But on NASA.gov, there are hundreds of photographs of galaxies. At the center, you can actually see the accretion disk of the black hole. So this is not a question of theory. It's just a question of measurement. We know the escape velocity of these objects is the speed of light, so they are black holes.
I think I found one from one of our moderators by the name of the Borg, and so I'm going to apologize. I'm going to apologize to all our other fans, listeners, and members if we didn't ask your question. Sorry, we just ran out of time. The Borg asked this: Doctor, we live in a very interesting universe, and it's even speculated that, of course, that it might be a multiverse. With this M theory, we're looking at a conglomeration of universes all touching each other, separated by a membrane of some kind, hence the M in M theory. If we couple this with the map of the known universe, patterns seem to emerge that suggest not only divine inspiration, but innate intelligence. My question is this, Doctor, how likely is it that we are merely components of a much larger creature?
Well, if you saw the movie Men in Black, at the end of the movie, you realize that our entire galactic neighborhood is nothing but a small little marble in somebody's marble game.
Right.
Let's define a few words. First of all, M theory. I work on string theory. String theories vibrate in 10 dimensions, and that seems to be the most logical theory of everything, the theory of the universe. However, if you add one more dimension to make it 11-dimensional, magic occurs, all sorts of mathematical identities take place, and the string then is stretched to become a tube, in other words, a membrane. So if you take a beach ball and you take a look at the equator of a beach ball, the equator of a beach ball is a loop, in other words, a string. So strings could be compressed membranes, and that's where M of M theory comes from. M theory comes out of Princeton, and it does seem to unify many of the equations of string theory, and our universe is probably a membrane. I talked about the soap bubble, that we live on the skin of the soap bubble.
Right,
soap bubble,
right.
It's expanding. That's a membrane. And as this gentleman pointed out, perhaps our membrane could be colliding or bumping into or connected to other membranes. These connections are called wormholes. So imagine a bubble bath with bubbles floating with little tubes connecting the soap bubbles. And these tubes are gateways. And most of the time, they're very small, so small that you can't go through them. But mathematically, there should be tubes connecting these soap bubbles. And that is the picture of the multiverse that we have today. Now, the question is, if you look on a tremendously large scale, do you see evidence of a creature? Do you see evidence of a super atom? Well, we have a picture, in fact, it's on NASA.gov, of our quadrant of the universe. And we don't see any structure to it. It seems to have lots of clumping due to something called dark matter. But in our sector of the universe, consisting of, you know, several billion galaxies, we don't see any structure that corresponds to an organism or a creature. But now if you take a look at our entire bubble, then this gentleman asks another question. What happens if our bubble universe is like an atom, and the atom is connected to other atoms to create a super-duper creature? Well, you can't rule that out. Our telescopes don't go that far. Our telescopes can only see 100 billion galaxies. That's the limit of our telescopes. So you can actually count the stars in the visible universe. Each galaxy has 100 billion stars. There are 100 billion galaxies within the range of our telescopes. So the total number of stars in the visible universe is 100 billion times 100 billion. On that scale, we don't see any structure. We just see random clumpiness of the 100 billion galaxies that are visible by telescopes. But this gentleman asks another question. If our universe is a bubble and we coexist with other bubbles, can they in turn make a molecule? That I don't know. That would require a metaphysics even beyond M theory.
So you're saying the jury's out on whether or not we're part of some large galactic amoeba?
Not even galactic, super universe, even beyond the universe. On a galactic scale, we see no evidence of any structure except clumpiness. But even beyond that, perhaps even universes can have structure. We don't know.
All right. We know that you've got a number of books that are available now. Are you working on a new book?
I'm thinking about another book, right? Physics of the Impossible was a bestseller, much to my surprise. 5 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. So, I'm thinking about another book right now, but I'm not exactly sure what.
Okay.
Maybe some of your listeners can give me some ideas.
Oh, perfect. Well, there you go,
that's
listeners.
That's a good idea. That's a great idea.
Well, we can't thank you enough, Doctor, for coming back for the part two of our interview with you.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
And we'll live long and prosper, Doctor.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Doctor. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Take care.
All right, thanks, Doc.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.AboveTopSecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. We'll be right back.